Welcome back. This is Concurrent Podcast Episode 3. Today we're going to talk about coroutines. I'm Arne Klassen, Senior Developer at MindTouch.
And I'm Steve Bjork, Chief Architect. So we have brought up coroutines quite a few times, actually now our previous two podcasts and quite a few times on our blog. And it's quite an involved subject, but we definitely need to tackle it at some point, and why not during Podcast 3? So quick, I did a little bit of background research on coroutines. I thought that might be interesting. So the term coroutine was coined by Melvin Conway in 1963 in an article. And so at first I actually confused him with another famous Conway, John Horton Conway, who is best known for the Game of Life and also a famous book called On Numbers and Games. But there's absolutely no relationship between the two. So Melvin Conway is the guy who coined the term coroutines, and it's a generalization of subroutines.
Any reason why it's coroutines?
That's a good question. I mean, if you look at how what subroutines are, which were the second generation of functions, really. The first generation of functions were what we call today go-to statements.
Right.
We would just jump left and right, and we just go right to it. Subroutines had a nice capability that you would call a subroutine, and upon exiting, it would go back to its invoking context. So you didn't have to pass it in explicitly. There was this implicit information being passed in. Coroutines, on the other hand, the way they are strictly implemented is really you can jump into a coroutine, it will execute some steps, and then it will jump into another coroutine. So coroutine has basically several entry points and exit points.
So the co might be for continuation.
Maybe, yes. Yeah. And Donald News, who's of course a luminary in the computer science world, did some further analysis, and it's pretty much that the subroutine at the end of the day is a special case of a coroutine, because a coroutine can do more things.
Right.
Now, when we talk about coroutines in the .NET world, we don't really have, strictly speaking, coroutines. What .NET has instead are generators. Or iterators. So the
and we've only had that since 2.0, right? Yeah.
Yes, correct. It was the introduction of the yield statement, and that opened a whole new world in the context of asynchronous programming. So the difference between an iterator and a coroutine is a coroutine, when it exits, it basically says, "I want to jump to this other coroutine and do some work there." In an iterator, you really exit to an outer context. So again, a little bit like what a subroutine does. So it's kind of a hybrid between these two. But that's how we have implemented now for each loops and things of that sort, enumerating collections. The very, very popular pattern has been very, very powerful. And actually, has recently, Eric Mayer did some work on twisting it on its head. Instead of being a pull pattern, it became a push pattern. And that's the reactive framework, which is a topic for another podcast, but also very much in line with asynchronous programming, parallel programming. The closest thing we have today in terms of coroutines is not really in .NET, but in many of the lower level C++ frameworks are fibers. So fibers are lightweight threads that then do cooperative multitasking by relegating their place on the stack to somebody else. So those are fibers. But now let's talk about the application of this iterator pattern to what we call coroutines in .NET and in asynchronous programming. I know you've made quite a bit of use already of that.
Yeah, I mean, before I used to do all my programming or my asynchronous programming with message passing concurrency, the actor model, basically. Anytime you had something, you basically stuffed it into a queue, it went off to somewhere else. But one of the things with that is that you're completely losing the concept of a linear flow, what you usually think of as a stack, where one thing calls another and there's a flow of information. You're going, I'm doing a little bit of thing, and then I'll send a new message, and eventually a message will come back, and some, depending on what kind of message passing you're using, there might be correlation of, oh, this is a reply to this message. And other systems, like by default, most of the systems like Scala and Erlang, really just, they receive events. They don't really necessarily even care that it is a response to a previous event. Very powerful, but you start thinking about your code in a very linear way. And so when I started playing with the coroutines, it was just so nice because you're saying, I'm going to do this, then I'm going to call this asynchronous call, and then I'm going to do the next thing. And it looks like a normal method. except that you're not blocking on any of these things. And that's one of the really neat things about coroutines.
Yes, and I think that's also why they're so important to the concurrent world, because if you have thousands of concurrent operations going on, you do not want to have each of these operations be blocking on a thread. So from an implementation point of view, the way a coroutine works, at least the way it works in Mindtouch Dream, is it's using the iterator pattern. So you implement a method, and at various points in it, it will use the yield statement, yield return, to indicate that it's basically waiting for an operation to complete before it can continue. And that's very much how you would do like an enumeration of a collection, and that's kind of what's going on here. So you do a couple of steps, maybe you initialize some data structures, and then you kick off a request saying, hey, I want to fetch this web request, this data from some high latency resource, and when I'm ready, call me back and I will continue my work. And so that's the yield return. That allows the system to remove this invocation from the stack and go on with something else. And underneath the covers, we have this coroutine driver, the iterator, which is basically responsible for checking if a coroutine can immediately continue or if it may need to wait, and then when the asynchronous operation completes, it gets scheduled back on. But fundamentally, it's the iterator pattern, but it kind of like twists it on its head.
Right. It's everybody that, well, most people that are familiar with yield are used to, okay, I'm going to create an enumerable, and instead of returning my entire collection, I'm going to just give you one item at a time, which is a very good pattern, but that means that you're producing something else that everybody else just will call with a for each, while with the coroutine pattern, you're really using it to write your code, while the for each that wraps everything around it is completely invisible to you, because it's basically the framework underneath it that makes it happen for you.
Yeah, correct. And that has led us to some interesting...
oh, yes.
Quite a bit of code writing and rewriting. Getting coroutines right is a pretty tricky little task. But the big deal is really because the coroutine, when it says yield return, it basically exits its current call frame from the stack, and it captures any variables that it needs to use in its continuation. Automatically, the compiler does that for you. It greatly simplifies programming. The alternative would be, like you were saying before, the style that exists in Erlang, where the state has to be kind of like pushed forward explicitly.
Right.
Here, C#, since 2.0, can do all the capturing for you and push it into a lower frame. And your code doesn't look like a set of nested continuations, like when done this, then when done that, then when done that, which are all callbacks and anonymous delegates. Instead, it really reads almost like a synchronous method, but with all the benefits of scalability and parallelism that you get by not holding on to the current thread.
Yeah, I guess with the existing asynchronous programming pattern that people use in .NET, you could simulate something that looks linear by just doing exactly like you said, just basically writing these anonymous closures that are just basically do this, and then when it returns to that, and so it still stays in one functional routine, but if you look at it, it'll just kind of keep indenting to the right because you're going to go into another closure and another closure, which again becomes really nasty to follow and debug.
Yeah, definitely. That's really, I think, the biggest benefit of the coroutines, is that it does provide this seemingly synchronous programming pattern while giving you all the benefits of actually doing things asynchronously. Now, those are the benefits. Now, the drawbacks are that at the end of the day, the support for iterators or iterator rewriting in C# to date isn't 100%. And there are a few things where gotchas are very, very tricky. So when you write an iterator, you cannot do a yield return inside a try catch statement.
Surprisingly, you can use a finally, though.
Yes.
Try finally.
Yes, which was very surprising. It turns out that if you use a using statement or try finally, which are pretty much the same thing, the iterator somehow magically will remember that it had things to dispose in case you were to abandon the iteration, and then will dispose them for you when the iterator gets disposed, or the enumerable object, which is really a fantastic rewrite. So now you combine that with anonymous methods, and which is also a rewrite,
right.
Or anonymous delegates is the real correct term, or lambda functions, and you suddenly have the compiler having to deal with two kinds of rewrites, both the anonymous methods and the iterative rewrite.
And recently, actually, when Eric Lippert was talking about how yield works, he was talking about that one of the reasons why we don't have the full capability is because right now the way it happens is it is two different steps. It first rewrites one set and the other, and then rewrites the other set. So it rewrites the, I think, all the closure capturing first, and then it rewrites the yields. And if you wanted to be able to do try-catch while yielding, you'd have to actually have just one pass where you're alternately processing one or the other instead of processing them separately.
Yeah, and these compiler rewrites, as with any compiler, with, I mean, you have to be sure that basically the program that is generated from the source is has the same semantics as the source was intended to have. We're always very, very tricky business. And yeah. One of the results is that, unfortunately, because of those limitations today in the C# compiler, and there doesn't seem to be an immediate fix for it coming up, it's not in C# 4.0,
yeah.
Which I was disappointed by, but I mean, I can understand the cost being involved with it, is the fact that you can't have an anonymous delegate that you can yield from.
Yeah, that's another one.
And that's really unfortunate, because once you have a great framework that's really designed to take advantage of these iterators for creating asynchronous methods, so these coroutines, it would be nice if you could pass in, you know, anonymous delegates. So you basically just pass in functionality, say, okay, yield this, yield that, and so on and so forth, just like you do your regular programming, but you can't, which means then you have to do explicit declarations, which means that you have to pass in state.
Right.
You get none of these benefits. And so while coroutines have a great benefit in the most common case, they unfortunately run fairly early on as you get more advanced into limitations in the compiler, which you didn't have to work around.
Right. Well, and one other thing with coroutines that makes them a little bit trickier, at least the way we have implemented them, is that the signature gets more complicated because we're always requiring a result object. Now, strictly speaking, there's nothing about yield that requires it, but the moment we say yield, we're really saying that this call may never return, so we need to have some way to do cancellation and timeout, and that's where result comes in. And so the signatures of coroutines gets a bit more verbose than a normal method call.
Yes, and also today, because of the limitation in anonymous delegates, if the way we're usually implementing is we have to implement two methods. One is the actual coroutine that has the yield return type, which is an enumerable of iYield, which is our interface for allowing the continuation to be triggered by the coroutine driver. But invoking that directly is kind of ugly, because when you invoke a coroutine, when you call one of these iterators, what happens is that the part between the first invocation and the first yield return statement, that's actually happening on the stack of the method that called you. So if that part throws an exception, you would get back, you would have to actually use a try catch to catch it. Whereas anything that happens afterwards gets automatically captured by the coroutine driver and put into the result object. You just check if the result has an exception. So we wanted to avoid that you had to check both places, because that would be really ugly and it's just too verbose. I mean, every single time you would have to use a try catch around it, and we know that's not possible.
Well, and you'd have to know the implementation of the method you're calling, because you don't know what parts are happening before and after.
Correct. I mean,
and it could change.
Yes, so you would always have to do it. So instead, we decided to say, like, okay, that doesn't make any sense. Let's always have a method that makes it look, that gives it the standard asynchronous method pattern that we have, which is list all the parameters you take, then take the result object, which is our asynchronous completion object, which is also returned for convenience, and then call the actual coroutine with the driver, which then will do all the wrapping for you and so on, and make sure that if an exception happened in the first part, it would still be triggered on the result. So you only need to check that. You don't need to worry about anything else. But that's an inconvenience. That means then suddenly, okay, well, now I need to, whenever I write my coroutines, I need to write a little asynchronous method pattern as method as well, so that it can be easily invoked. in the grand scheme of things, it turns out that asynchronous method pattern, which is really a topic for another podcast, is the generalization of everything, and coroutine is an implementation detail of an asynchronous method.
Right, because it could just be a I/O blocking call versus going through a coroutine that you're doing asynchronously.
Correct, and it's really just, you know, your own preference. If you prefer to use the coroutine pattern for splitting out your work into multiple items, or if you rather have a continuation passing style as it is used in other systems. So, but still, I mean, we use coroutines quite extensively in our code base. All our base pattern for services, what we call features, which are basically the methods of services, are all following the coroutine pattern, because as soon as you hit the web world, it's latencies galore, and you really don't want to hold on to a thread because you're doing a request to some foreign resource on the web, which is going to take milliseconds to respond. I mean, milliseconds are just an eternity for the runtime.
Right. Yeah. The one interesting, or the caveat that you quickly fall into with coroutines, is that the moment you're inside of coroutine, if you call anything else, you really need to be calling, it needs to also be a coroutine so you can yield it.
Yep.
Because the moment you make one synchronous call, you've basically fallen out of the capability of making any kind of asynchronous call inside of it. Because, well, you're now outside of the iterator. You can't yield back to the iterator, which means that if you have something synchronous and it needs to do something asynchronous, the only way that it can do it is by making a blocking call. So you're really... there is a bit of a commitment. The moment you start going into coroutines, you kind of saying that everything that happens from here on will have this type of signature.
Yeah, you have to only call asynchronous things. Otherwise, you totally lose the benefit of coroutines. So coroutines are really interesting, and the complexities of them go quite a bit further and actually beyond what we do today. So some of the work that's going on in what I dubbed the... Gene Profile 2 effort is to clean things a little bit up and make the whole system work a little bit smoother. And we already have some of these benefits in the new Dream that was released in 1.7. It's a much faster coroutine drive already and much lower overhead. But that's an improvement there. But what we don't have yet is cancellation injection, for example. So there's a lot of work going on with handling cancellations. And so one of the hopes is that with coroutines, one of the limitations today in 1.7 is when you look at the coroutine, you don't really know who invoked it. So we already have some prototype code there that will allow you to actually walk the call chain, which may make it much easier to actually know where you're at. Don't forget, I mean, a coroutine fragment, so it's coming back from in a yield return. You just finished doing your web request against, you know, a Google API. And you're happily processing your XML, and maybe you're running or your JSON object, and you run into some kind of error. So you look at your stack. Right. What does your stack look like? Well, you're pretty much sitting right on top of a dispatch thread,
right,
because that's where your completion happened. I mean, the original call context is completely gone. It's, you know, it deallocated itself from the stack and went away. The whatever stack was there originally may have been used for 1,000 operations since then. So there's absolutely no correlation.
It's definitely one of the big surprises the first time you debug a coroutine. You go, stack. Okay,
what stack?
Where did I come from? There's nothing here.
Exactly. So that's a little frustrating. And, you know, with some investigative work, you can eventually figure it out and so on and so forth. But it's not the easiest way to go about. So tracking the originating coroutine that called you and so on is work that's in progress. And that will make debugging a little bit easier. The other thing that benefit that we'll get from it is at least we're looking at it, we don't know if we're going to be able to pull it off, is the kind of like cancellation injection.
Right.
Namely, a coroutine is calling another coroutine, and so they're all, you know, happily working away and waiting for each other to complete, and they do that all without using any stack space. And suddenly, you know, the other context says, hey, I'm no longer interested in the result, and I need to cancel. Well, since there is no active polling or so on going on, right? You cannot check, like, well, is my have been canceled, and should I therefore return early? I mean, you're waiting for somebody else to return. You're the coroutine in between. So there needs to be a mechanism there to basically actively figure out how to cancel that operation. And with cancellation comes a whole bunch of other things, which are way out of topic here. But let me just hint at it, namely resources that need to be disposed.
You got to clean up after yourself.
Yes.
Cleanup doesn't happen at the same time that you found out it canceled, because the other guy might not respect your cancel and still keep going.
Correct. You cannot clean up your resources until the other coroutine you have invoked has actually finished processing, either by acknowledging your cancel or by returning a value. Otherwise, you would be like basically pulling the rug underneath its feet. But these are all kinds of like interesting little problems that suddenly start cropping up once you really start embracing the asynchronous programming pattern. And inside the asynchronous programming pattern, we like coroutines a lot because it makes our life easier. But it also comes with a certain amount of pitfalls and other headaches that need to be resolved. But these are not unique to coroutines.
No. And they're definitely not unsurmountable, considering that the alternative is some other asynchronous programming pattern, which none of which are straightforward. So it's
correct.
Not like you're going to say, well, there's the easy way. Well, there isn't an easy way. There's just different trade-offs.
Yeah, I mean, the problems are real and are completely unrelated to coroutines. They have to do fundamentally with asynchronous concurrent programming, where things just happen in a slightly different order or timing than they would do in a normal stack-based first in, first out.
Right.
Well, actually, it's last in, first out order.
Yes.
And so we have to deal with these problems. They're just a reality. And we have to deal with them not just in terms of making sure that our programs are correct, that they do the right thing at the right time, and they can cope with doing the right thing at the right time. These are two different concepts. If the framework doesn't allow you to do the right thing, you're kind of stuck. But it also, with providing a pattern to follow that isn't incredibly tedious and cumbersome and just not conducive to good programming practices. I mean, again, right. That's the whole philosophy over following certain patterns as opposed to just using basic building blocks to assemble it into the right things, and then nobody does it because it's too tedious.
Right. Yeah, and coroutines, at least in many ways, once you get over the signatures of the methods, that is the kind of a little bit more complex, and that you have to do yields at the end. Coroutines do look a lot like methods. So once you get the basic syntactic sugar down, you can kind of continue programming as if you were doing linear synchronous programming. But you get the benefit of that it really handles it for you in an asynchronous manner.
Yep, that's the nice thing about coroutine. It just looks a lot like synchronous methods. And I wish the compiler provided a little bit more magic to continue supporting that illusion.
Well, we can hope that these paradigms will pick up and it'll eventually make it into the runtime.
Yeah, well, I mean, the other one is when you hit a breakpoint inside a coroutine, every so often it can't figure out what the parameters were to the coroutine.
Yeah, or that any kind of class field becomes like, oh, you're calling it statically, therefore this is out of scope. Like, no, it's not. But those are less, I mean, those are not even framework problems as much as that just Visual Studio probably just was not built to recognize these things. It has certain optimizations to make the debugger run that goes, oh, well, I didn't think you would be able to do that.
Yeah, well, I was able to excuse them in Visual Studio 8 because that was just C# 2.0 was new, but
right.
Now we are 9 and it's still doing the same thing. So hopefully
true.
With the great work going on with the Parallel.net team, which undoubtedly is running into similar kind of issues that we are, they'll put some pressure on the Visual Studio team to get these little issues addressed. They're really just inconveniences. In general, then they aren't showstoppers, but you know, when you're trying to hunt down a bug, every little hurdle, extra hurdle you have to overcome, and it's already such a complex world of things happening in different orders than you expect them to be, is an additional complexity we can do without.
Right. All right, I think that is our time for this week. I hope we introduced you to some new interesting concepts. You can play around with our coroutine infrastructure inside of Dream, and it's not limited to just using it for web services. We just build our web servers on top of coroutines, but you can do just any kind of coroutine-based programming with the facilities that are in Dream.
Yep, and I'm also going to plug your... You have had several blog posts already on our blog,
true.
So go check out Arne's blog posts. They're very informative, very detailed. They're really great reading material to get an idea how these things work and how you can apply them.
All right, well, thank you. And as always, check out our website for the upcoming topics. And if you have topics you want us to cover, just make suggestions. We're always interested to see where people want us to go with this.
Okay, thanks a lot.